up in horsey heaven, hear the thing. You trade your legs for angels' wings. And once we've all said goodbye, you take a running leap and you learn to fly.
For all you out there looking for something good, something bad, or a bit of both, may we present Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. I'm Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who's after those blasted Infinity Stones.
Mike Scricchio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. Try as hard as you might, Mike. I will destroy the universe. It'll happen. It's going to happen.
It might take 15, 16 movies, but...
it'll happen one day.
Get there. You know, Thanos has now been looking for Infinity Stones for 15 Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, if we're starting from the beginning, and he hasn't gotten a single one.
Just you wait. He'll get his chance, Mike.
Yeah, I hope so. I honestly, I just want him to have a win.
You know, he really deserves it at this point.
He really deserves it. Now, if you've never listened to a Film Bookcast before, usually that's what we do. We side with the villain in whatever movie we're talking about.
Of course.
But usually we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we will move on to our featured review. This week, it is the newest film from director James Gunn, the sequel to Guardians of the Galaxy, and the 15th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Are you excited to talk about this, Mike?
Yes. Of course.
Absolutely. It's our requisite Marvel episode that happens every couple of months.
Yep. Yeah, if you're a new listener, strap in. It's going to be 2 hours of us just going, oh my God.
That is not an exaggeration. So, yeah, but before we get into all that, Mike, we should get into some film news. All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we have a few things to get through today since it's been about 3 weeks, I think, since our last episode of Film Bookcast, since we skipped we were going to do Free Fire, but that never ended up happening. So we got some film news things to talk about, and I think this one is very, very exciting. Jeff Goldblum has joined the cast of Jurassic World 2.
Oh, man. We're in a Jeff Goldblumissance.
The Blumissance. No, the Blumissance. You gave it a shot. I mean, he was in Independence Day 2. He's going to be appearing in Thor 3, and now he's going to be in Jurassic World 2. Or Jurassic Park 5. Is it Jurassic Part 5, First Blood Part 2? Or how does this work?
It's something like that. I'm excited to have his character back. He's the most ridiculous one in the first Jurassic World.
Sure.
Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park 2 is a terrible movie, but it holds a dear, dear place in my heart as being the first PG-13 movie I've ever seen in theaters.
You're a big fan of Jurassic Park 2.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm excited to have Dr. Malcolm back.
Yeah, I think that'll be really exciting to just have him in the cast. I'm curious what this means in regards to The Lost World, actually, because when Jurassic World came out, there was a lot of talk about how it was going to ignore the events of 2 and 3, those movies didn't exist. But if they're bringing back Jeff Goldblum, does that mean that The Lost World happened?
I guess? I don't know. Because, I mean, he's in the first one, so they could still pretend only Jurassic Park happened.
I guess so.
It would be weird. But they could.
I mean, they could just not mention it, but it would be odd for them to be able to open up a dinosaur park after dinosaurs attacked San Diego or whatever it was. Was it San Diego in that movie, right? You know that movie better than I do.
It would definitely be really weird, considering that's where almost all, he's the star of that, of The Lost World, right?
So,
all of his characterization, or most of it, happens in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's where he gets the daughter in that movie, his gymnast daughter who attacks Velociraptors with her kicks, and all that kind of
stuff.
Like
any good daughter would.
so maybe she'll come back too. Who knows? But what I'm wondering about, and I think we talked about this in our Jurassic World review, but that was 2 years ago, so I'll refresh your memory. Maybe this could mean that my dream Jurassic Park 5 is actually coming to fruition, Mike.
It's possible at this point.
Do you remember what my dream Jurassic Park 5 was?
If I remember correctly, it's basically Fast and the Furious, but yes, with dinosaurs.
You are 100% right. I want Fast 5, where, you know, they brought back all these disparate characters from all their different movies and, like, reunited them into one movie to pull off some kind of elaborate heist.
Right.
That's exactly what I want, because the Jurassic Park movies have that. They have, like, all these different characters and all these different movies, right? So if they brought back, you know, Sam Neill, Jeff Goldblum, and Laura Dern from the first movie,
right,
and then from the second movie they plucked in, like, Julianne Moore and Vince Vaughn, and then from the third movie they brought in that little kid who survived on an island for, like, 3 months.
Yeah.
And maybe
I'm on board already.
And maybe, like, William H. Macy, I don't know. And then from Jurassic Park 4, they'll have, you know, Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard. You got a movie right there. That's
– yeah.
And they have to, like, you know, go for one last job back to the island to steal one of the dinosaur eggs before whatever the company – Initech? No, Initech is Office Space.
Engine.
I said the one from Office Space. Yeah, InGen, before they get their hands on this dinosaur egg, that they could replicate their own dinosaurs or something. You know, something, whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. As long as they're all
those, yeah, it just,
as long as they're just all
make
together,
it crazy.
As long as they're all together doing Ocean's 11 against a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
I'm in.
Boom.
T-Rex voiced by Andy Garcia.
I'm upset that it's not a movie now. but yeah, this movie will have Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard, and Jeff Goldblum. So we are this close, man.
Yeah, we're almost there.
We're almost there. So we'll keep you posted on updates about that, because if they bring back, like, Sam Neill and Laura Dern, then I'm like, oh man, it's starting to happen. It's starting to happen. Because I think that would be the best route for this franchise to take. I think most franchises should go the Fast Five route and just go fucking insane in the fifth one. But you know, we'll see what happens. At this point, let's move on to some other news, Mike.
Okay.
Because it looks like David Fincher, who was one of the most distinctive and celebrated directors of the past 20 years, is actually directing the World War Z sequel. I remember that was, like, a rumor about a year ago, and we talked about that on the podcast. And the reason we talked about it on the podcast, because we usually don't talk about rumors, but the reason we talked about that one is because it was so ridiculous that we had to laugh at it.
This will never happen.
And now it looks like it's happening. Yeah, did you see this coming at all, Mike?
No. Who the fuck could? I think this is an insane sentence. One, because why do we need another World War Z movie?
Yeah, a World War Z-quel.
A World War Z-quel. I don't remember this. I don't remember it being a particularly huge success, the first one.
I think maybe I just was. Don't really. I think it was a solid hit, but it was one of those things where, like, it made a decent amount of money, but nobody really was that crazy about it.
Right. Okay. You know? So that's the first level of insanity. And then the second one is that David Fincher is going to do a sequel to this? Like, what?
Now, David Fincher has not made a sequel to anything since his very first movie, which was Alien 3. And he had such a horrible time making that movie that he kind of swore off these kind of big franchise movies. You know, he's made his
right.
He's been doing his own thing. And in more recent years, I would say probably, like since Alien 3, probably the closest to this that he's gotten was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo,
right.
Which was a remake of a foreign language film that was intended to launch a franchise that never ended up happening. And they are trying again with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the studio is. But but so it's interesting that David Fincher would return back to this. And it seems like the main reason is that, you know, it stars Brad Pitt. Who starred in the first movie, and he's been trying to get this movie off the ground for a little while. And I was actually reading a little bit about this, and I can't confirm that this is what happened, but I think this might be what happened. As you may know, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are getting divorced.
Right.
Well, apparently Brad Pitt got kicked, like isn't staying at the house anymore. He got kicked out of the house, whatever. And he's been staying on David Fincher's floor. Apparently that's 100% true.
Wow.
And so my thinking is that, you know, Brad Pitt has been pestering David Fincher about this for so long that David Fincher was like, you know what? I will direct this if you get out of my house.
If you will move out, I'll direct a movie for you.
So that is my theory about what's happening. That's probably not
No, but it sounds possible.
It sounds like it could be a thing. So we'll say it is a thing. Yeah, I mean, I love David Fincher. I will watch whatever he does. And that's the thing. I had no intention of watching a sequel to World War Z. I thought World War Z was mediocre at best, you know? but if David Fincher's doing it, like, you know, he's not one to, pull his punches, you know,
yeah.
I think part of the problem with World War Z is that it's aiming for a PG-13 rating and it's like a big, like, four quadrant wide release blockbuster movie. I think David Fincher would go for an R rating for World War Z and I think the studio would let him. I think the only way he would do this if they, you know, he's obviously Brad Pitt asked him to, but also because, like, David Fincher's a guy who needs creative control over his thing, you know? I think the studio would give that to him.
I would hope so. If there's we say this a lot, right? But David Fincher is definitely, like, the one director that I think a studio would be like, yeah, go ahead, just do your thing. Or should be like that, at least.
And I think his most recent film was Gone Girl, and that was a pretty sizable hit, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's precedent there, and David Fincher is the man. So I'm down for whatever he does, and if he wants to do a zombie movie, then I'm in, because...
Like, sure.
Like, I love zombie movies, and I love David Fincher. If it happens to be a World War sequel, then so be it, I guess.
Yeah.
But it will be...
That's just a burden you'll have to bear, Mike.
Absolutely, yeah. So that will be definitely something to keep an eye on, because that is a pretty insane thing that's in the works right there. But here's something that's even more insane, Mike. Something that was previously unfathomable before a few months ago. And we should say, spoilers for Split.
Okay. Yep.
Spoilers for the M. Night Shyamalan movie Split, which just came out a couple of months ago, starting right now. If you don't want to hear any spoilers for Split, and I highly recommend you don't.
If you haven't seen it.
If you haven't seen the movie. If you've seen the movie, it's okay to hear spoilers for Split. You'll survive. But if you haven't seen the movie, I highly recommend you go in as, you know, blind as possible, because there's some insanity that happens there that applies to this next news story. So spoilers for Split starting right now. M. Night Shyamalan has officially announced the Split/Unbreakable sequel called Glass. And it's going to feature Bruce Willis, Samuel L. Jackson, James McAvoy, and Anya Taylor-Joy all returning to their roles. It's going to be released in January 2019, produced by Blumhouse. And that is pretty insane, Mike.
Yeah.
Can you believe it?
If there's one other sentence that I didn't think would happen besides David Fincher directing a World War Z sequel, it's this next story.
Yeah, I do have one more story that I think is also a sentence you never thought would happen. So.
Oh my God, Mike, you gotta warn me.
I gotta cool down.
Yeah.
But before we get into that story, yeah, this is insane. I mean, Split, you know, kind of, I mean, I liked Split more than you did.
And I think that was by virtue of the fact that the twist didn't land for me.
Right, because you hadn't seen Unbreakable.
Yeah, so don't worry about it.
Which is part of the problem. If you haven't seen Unbreakable, then that twist isn't going to land for you. But if you have seen Unbreakable, chances are you've been patiently waiting for news about an Unbreakable sequel for about 15 years. And so the fact that M. Night Shyamalan is actually following through on that and, you know, doing this crossover with Split is pretty insane. And we had talked about the possibilities of what that could be in our Split review, which you can find at filmbook.com or on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever podcasts are sold. So I think that's a really cool thing. And it's going to be, I guess, Bruce Willis versus James McAvoy with Samuel Jackson kind of like popping up. I really don't know what this movie could be.
Yeah, could be anything at this point.
Could be really anything, man. I'm just so happy that Shyamalan's back. Like, he's really like, he's made a huge, like, this kind of level of comeback, I feel like, is almost unprecedented. Like, I'm sure it's happened before, but it just feels like he was in the dirt, man. Like,
yeah. And yeah, it's such a swing for him, right? Like, yeah. From the top of, he was the hottest, toppest director for however, I don't know, a very brief time, I feel like.
Yeah, with like The Sixth Sense and Unbreakable and Signs, like, those were all huge hits. Got a decent amount of critical acclaim, all those movies did. And then, you know, there's just that, like, gradual tumble down. Where there's like The Village and then Lady in the Water and then The Happening and The Last Airbender. Right. And, you know, all those movies were happening one after the other and they were getting like increasingly worse as they went on.
Yeah.
And you know, even if you look at the Rotten Tomatoes rankings of all those movies, they do get like progressively lower and it's kind of great to just watch them like kind of like fall.
Yeah.
Not like, I mean, and I'm somebody who is happy that he's back doing his thing now, but it's just like really interesting to see what happened. And like, I guess like he's just a filmmaker that hit it too big too early, I think.
Right.
And became somebody that you couldn't say no to almost. But then, you know, as these movies went on, you know, like at a certain point, like people would laugh at his name if you saw it in a movie trailer. Like, that's what happened. I remember that happening when I saw trailers for like Devil and stuff like that. And so now, like, you know, The Visit came out, and even when The Visit came out and it was advertising itself as like From the Mind of M. Night Shyamalan, like it still got the laughter a little bit, because it's like, oh, it's M. Night Shyamalan. And it's, even then, it was like 5 years since they had last used his name in a trailer. Because I remember they didn't use his name in the trailers for After Earth, specifically because of that reason.
yeah, it's definitely interesting too that you know, we always talk about Blumhouse is saving the horror world, or at least putting the team on its back, right? Yeah. We always praise a Blumhouse movie, so it's exciting to see that this tiny little production company is being used as the vehicle for the comeback for M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he was making all these huge big budget movies, and now he's scaled back and to do movies in like a $5-10 million budget. And he's turning out like a lot more success, like critically and financially. Like, these movies are like pretty big hits. Especially Split was like a really big hit.
I think it was 300. I just saw recently the theatrical run has finally finished like worldwide and stuff. It was almost $400 million. I think
it's a lot of money
on a budget of 10.
Yeah, that's insane. $10 million. So yeah, pretty psyched for this movie, Glass, the Unbreakable / Split sequel. I'm hopeful that it expands the Shyamalaverse in new and exciting ways. If it like somehow mixes in The Lady in the Water or something, I wouldn't be upset.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
it'd be silly, but yeah. So that's pretty insane news. And then finally, I do have one last bit of news. This just came out yesterday, actually. Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy, the comic book, announced online last night that there is a new R-rated Hellboy reboot in the works. Directed by Neil Marshall and featuring David Harbour from Stranger Things as Hellboy.
Yeah, I wonder how pissed Guillermo del Toro is.
I mean, what's interesting about that, I mean, I love Guillermo del Toro and I love Ron Perlman as Hellboy. And I've really never been the biggest fan of Hellboy 1, but Hellboy 2 is like amazing. Hellboy 2 is awesome. But what's interesting about those movies is that they're very different than what the Hellboy comics are like. You know, the comics are much more like darker and a little more down to earth and like go into like darker, like deeper subject matter and stuff like that.
Right.
Whereas Guillermo del Toro has like this elaborate fantasy land that Hellboy exists in. And I love Del Toro's vision for Hellboy 2 specifically. That movie is, again, awesome. But I think Mike Mignola, who gave those movies his blessing, is saying that, now this reboot's happening. Like, Hellboy 3 had been dead for a little while. I think even like Ron Perlman had said, like, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. And then Del Toro was like, I remember a few months ago, Del Toro like posted a poll on Twitter saying like, would you like Hellboy 3 to happen? If it gets like enough votes or whatever, I will meet with the creator and we'll see what we can do. I can't promise anything. And then like a week later, he's like, yeah, guys, it's not happening. I met with him, and, you know, whatever. it's like, way to get our hopes up, man. And like, I don't believe a Del Toro project is happening until I'm watching it in a theater anyway.
Right.
Because he attaches himself to so many things. But yeah, it's a little bit of a bummer that Del Toro will never get to make Hellboy 3, probably.
Yeah. In theory.
But then at the same time, this new Hellboy reboot is kind of enticing. Neil Marshall. Are you familiar with Neil Marshall at all, Mike?
No, I don't think I am.
Well, he was the director of this horror movie called The Descent a few years ago.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Have you seen The Descent?
Not all of it. I've seen clips and discussions of it and stuff.
Okay. Well, more recently, he's become known as a pretty major name on Game of Thrones. He was the director of The Battle of Blackwater, and also the director of The Watchers on the Wall, which is the like basically battle long episodes from season 2 and season 4, where season 4 was at like the wall, where it was like the Wildlings versus the Night's Watch and all that kind of cool stuff. And Blackwater obviously was a pretty famous one. So yeah, he can do pretty cool things, I think, Neil Marshall. So like the fact that he's on board and like David Harbour as Hellboy, like, is pretty wild casting.
Yeah, but he kind of like, he's got the jaw for it. Like, I never thought about it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I am into it. And I remember I saw David Harbour at Comic-Con last year at the Stranger Things panel. So it's like, oh, cool. I saw Hellboy in person.
I know that guy.
But yeah, so there's a lot of cool stuff to parse through there. And apparently they're looking to start filming by like September. So if this comes together, this could be pretty huge. And it's been almost 10 years since Hellboy 2, which is
holy shit,
pretty wild. Yeah, I was just thinking about this actually yesterday, that like it's almost been 10 years since The Dark Knight came out, and like how I'm gonna die one day. And
but, yeah, I mean, if there's anything that'll make you think about mortality, it's the lack of a Dark Knight movie, I guess.
Well, it's just like I hadn't like considered how like the passage of time since The Dark Knight came out. I feel like I had just seen The Dark Knight a couple years ago.
Right.
You know? But yeah, and The Dark Knight was like, you know, a formative movie for me, and that came out like a week before Hellboy 2 did. But yeah, so Hellboy reboot, pretty wild. A lot of pretty wild things happening in our news section today, Mike. So we gotta relax a little bit. I think we got
Let's take a breather.
Yeah, take a breather. Let's move on into our discussions.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, let's move on into our discussions for Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
This week I have another entry in our apparently continuing series of talking about a HBO series halfway through the season. So this week I'm talking about The Leftovers Season 3.
Okay.
We have 4 episodes so far, I believe, of a total of 8, right? This is the shorter final season.
The final season of The Leftovers, yeah, it's 8 episodes, and it's been airing for the past couple weeks. And yeah, so what are your thoughts, man? I've been watching it too.
Oh my God. If there's anything, like we just mentioned, The Dark Knight making you think about mortality and the slow progress of time. Leftovers just is like in your face about it.
100%.
Yeah. And I think The Leftovers is probably my favorite show on TV right now, possibly ever. It deals so upfront and in your face about the darkest and deepest questions that I think a lot of people don't want to allow themselves to think about, right? Like the concept of the show is that 2% of the world's population just vanished. The rapture, maybe, question mark. We don't know where they went, what happened. Yep. And I love, you know, one of my favorite things about the show in general is that it is about this giant global phenomenon, but on the smallest scale, right? Like we're viewing it from the viewpoint of one family in the beginning, and then we progress to one town. And it's the most unique, I think, show. It is, I don't want to go that far, I guess. But it manages to go where it's going, and it seems to not really care if the audience is coming with it,
or it
expects you to be able to keep up. And I can't tell what what angle they're taking for that, right? and that's one of my favorite parts about it, is that it's like, we're gonna just fucking do it. Yeah. Like I hope you're coming along with us, because we're gonna have a montage in slow motion set to Wu-Tang Clan jumping on a trampoline. Like,
yeah.
the best thing of the show.
Yeah, it's fucking amazing. Yeah, I'm also a huge fan of The Leftovers. I remember we both got into it around the same time. Like it had like just started on HBO in like season 1.
Yeah,
and I remember we were both kind of like in, like we had both started watching it around the same time, and my roommates had also started watching it around the same time, and it was kind of like. Like I didn't really know what to expect from it. I just knew it was like a new HBO drama, and I was like, "I'll check it out," because HBO usually puts out good stuff. And I knew Damon Lindelof was attached to do this thing, and so I was like, "Oh, I'll check it out." And I remember like the first 2 episodes, I was like, "Yeah, this is pretty good. I'm enjoying this show. Like, it's interesting. It's different. I don't really know where this is going." And then episode 3 of season 1 hit me like a fucking train wreck.
Yeah. Yep.
And then from there, I've just been hooked to the show, man. I do think it is one of the best shows on TV, and it might be one of the best shows ever. Like it's pretty insane. It's kind of a shame that it's ending after 3 seasons.
Yeah, I'm pretty torn. I think that is a huge benefit to it, right? Because it's not doing that weird meandering, trying to figure out how to stretch the story out so we can last for 10 seasons. We have 3 seasons of this story that we know what we want to tell, and we're just going to do it.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that is a huge benefit for the show. But also, like, we're going to have to live in a post-Leftovers world. Like.
That's the problem. I don't want it to end. And there's only 4 episodes left, and I don't know how to emotionally handle myself for that.
Yeah.
Because there have been so many episodes of The Leftovers that have just fucking torn me apart.
Yeah. We're just head in your hands while the credits roll at the end of the episode.
Yeah. I remember, my friend and I, EJ, would always text back and forth after every episode of season 2 of The Leftovers. We've been doing that a lot this season too. But I remember in season two, like every episode, I was just like, it was the most stressful viewing experience of my TV watching life. For I would say, other than maybe like waiting to see if Community was canceled or not.
Right.
Like
it's the most stressful TV exercise you can have.
Yeah, it is an intense show, and it's also like it can be depressing and it could be like emotionally draining. It's also hilarious. Like it's a really funny show a lot of the time. You just mentioned that fucking Wu-Tang Clan montage on the trampoline, which is like directly after this really like emotional scene.
Yeah. It's bizarre. And I love just like, I think because like they have this story planned out, it seems, right? They had all three seasons planned already. That there's a lot of stuff happening in season three that is picking up on like one scene that I thought was a throwaway joke in season one.
Yeah.
Right? Like in particular, episode three that focuses on Kevin Garvey Sr. In Australia. He talks about a thing that he did on the TV once, which happened in season one that I thought was a joke. And like, nope, it's a big plot point now.
Yeah. It's all tied together. And I don't want to spoil a lot of the things that happen in season three of Leftovers, but there is a buildup of like this throwaway joke in episode two. There's an actor who appears that's building off of a joke that appears in season two. And I think he appears in season two actually, and they build off that joke from season one. And it's pretty amazing. Just the opening credits are amazing.
Yeah.
This show is like nothing else on TV really. And it's really just insane. And I'm really upset that it's over, but at least Twin Peaks is coming back in a couple of weeks.
So we're going to,
it will hold the weirdness flag.
They overlap a little bit, right? I believe.
Yes. I think the last two episodes of The Leftovers air on the same night as the first two episodes of Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks. Okay.
And so that's going to cause me to stress the fuck out because I'm not going to know what to watch.
What are we going to do?
How am I going to survive? But
so that's Leftovers season three and kind of Leftovers as a whole. I'm excited for it to be over in that it's so short of a series that you'll be able to binge all of it at once.
That's true. Yeah,
and it'll be amazing.
I would like to rewatch the entire thing because there's just so much good stuff, man. There's so much good stuff. Christopher Eccleston's amazing. Carrie Coon is like a revelation in this show. And I'm excited. I haven't gotten a chance to start watching season three of Fargo, but she's in that too. And I'm pretty excited that, there's two major drama shows happening at the same time that have Carrie Coon in them.
Yeah. With hashtag bless.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's my discussion. What do you have this week, Mike?
Yep, so that's The Leftovers, and I got a couple of movies to talk about. The first is Free Fire, which is the new film from director Ben Wheatley. He was the director of the horror movie Kill List a few years ago. He also did High Rise with Tom Hiddleston last year, and this stars Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, Charlton Copley, and Cillian Murphy. And the conceit behind this movie is that it is an entire movie set in a warehouse during this movie-length gunfight between these two criminal groups. Like, the entire movie is just, like, this one prolonged gunfight. And I was pretty excited for that, you know, because that's a premise that, like, immediately gets my attention. I'm like, yes.
It sounds like Mike Smith, the movie.
That sounds like something I would love. But I got to be honest, I came away a little bit underwhelmed. You know, there is some fun stuff happening here. There's good stuff here. But it is pretty repetitive after a while. I think it does get a little tedious. And I think the biggest problem is that the action isn't all that distinctive. I think there's I had a difficult time placing where the action was happening. It's not even that the action is poorly shot. It's just that the geography of the room never quite coalesces. And so, you know, when you have this kind of like one setting location or this one location movie, you have to have a pretty good understanding of where everything is in relation to each other. And I feel like this movie doesn't have that. And so that hurts it in a pretty significant way. It just kind of felt like there should have been more there, even though there are a lot of funny moments. There's a lot of the funniest moments happen off screen. There's some great sound work in this movie where, like, you know, there's loud gunshots and all that kind of cool stuff. But like there will be like throwaway lines and jokes that you hear from a character on the other side of the room. While you're focusing on a different character, so you'll just hear like the voice in the background. Like a lot of times you can't even make it out, but there's like a lot of really funny stuff happening there. And all the actors are very solid, and the way the characters handle their guns seems to be like almost making a statement on how dangerous guns are, because they're handling them like they're real people instead of like movie characters.
Okay.
And so the gunfight is really messy, and a lot of times, most of the time, the characters miss, and you know that people get hurt and shot, and like they're wounded, and like I feel it's not as glamorized as Hollywood movie gunfights generally are. And so to that end, I think the movie is kind of interesting, and there is some good stuff happening here. But at the same time, I just feel like it's about 90 minutes, and it feels longer than that. It feels like, you know, you're just watching these people who none of them are particularly likable. And the movie goes out of the way to make them unlikable. Like that's definitely an intentional choice. But it's just, I feel like it seems like it's trying to say something, but it has no idea what it's saying, I guess. I guess is what I'm saying. And so, yeah, Free Fire, I mean, it's fine. Like, there is decent stuff in there. But I wasn't really blown away by it as I was hoping I would be. And I say blown away without meaning to make a gun pun. But so that's Free Fire. And if you want to go see it, you probably can't.
Probably missed it.
It played in theaters for, like, 3 days. It made very little money, but that is Free Fire. I'm sure it'll be streaming at some point in the near future. And then the other movie I wanted to talk about is actually somewhat related to our HBO discussion before. A while back, we reviewed the entire season one of the Westworld TV series, Mike.
Yes, we did.
we set aside an entire episode to talk about Westworld, and I had not seen the movie that the TV show is based on. So it happened to be airing on TCM a couple weeks ago, and I taped it, and I watched it. So I watched the original 1973 Westworld, directed and written by Michael Crichton, the guy who wrote Jurassic Park, among several other things. I believe this was the only movie he ever directed, and this stars Yul Brynner, James Brolin, and Richard Benjamin. Richard Benjamin is actually the director of Racing with the Moon with Nicolas Cage.
Wow, look at that. Yeah. We've crossed over.
We're crossing the podcast streams. So I went back to watch this now that I've seen the first season of the show, and it's a pretty solid B-movie that doesn't even try to approach the concept the way the show does. The show is doing a lot more interesting things conceptually with it, but the movie is pretty tense. Yul Brynner's gunslinger chasing Richard Benjamin during the last third of the movie. It's like Terminator before Terminator. You know, it's very similar to that. And everything in this movie kind of feels like it would be explored a lot more fully in later stuff. For example, the idea of a unique theme park whose subjects turn against the patrons is the subject of another well-known Michael Crichton novel.
I can't place it. I don't know if I can.
It's Congo. I'm talking about Congo.
Oh, okay. Outbreak. Got it. Yeah.
But it is pretty entertaining. Plus, you also see a medieval world and Roman world in this movie. So those are pretty neat if you want to try. Maybe that's a sneak glimpse of what season two of Westworld will have to offer. Who knows? Probably not. But I mean,
There is a glimpse of it.
Westworld season one did offer a glimpse at Samurai World, which I'm pretty into. So I remember you had mixed feelings about Samurai World.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot more to it. This movie is a good basis for what you can expect from the show, I think, almost because it's the opposite of what the show is. It kind of starts off like kind of exploring some of the similar themes of the show. But by the end of it, it becomes like, you know, this is more about the humans than about the robot. It's about the humans being terrorized by robots, whereas the show is almost about the robots being terrorized by humans.
What?
Oh, man.
My mind is blown.
Boom. But yeah, Westworld is a good watch, though. I do recommend checking that movie out, especially if you like the show. I think it's an interesting thing to check out. But anyway, that's what I have for my discussions this week. Mike, do you want to move on to our featured review?
I think it's time.
Let's do it. Let's move on to our featured review of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
The fate of the universe lies on your shoulders. Now, whatever you do, don't push this button. Because that will set off the bomb immediately and we'll all be dead. Now, repeat back what I just said.
I am Groot.
No! Now that's the button that will kill everyone! Try again.
I am Groot.
Mm-hmm.
I am Groot.
Uh-huh.
I'm Groot.
No!
All right, that was from the trailer for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, the new movie directed by James Gunn and starring Chris Pratt, Zoe Saldana, Dave Bautista, Vin Diesel, Bradley Cooper, Michael Rooker, Karen Gillan, Palm Clementeef, Elizabeth Debicki, Chris Sullivan, Sean Gunn, Sylvester Stallone, and Kurt Russell, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 reads, set to the backdrop of Awesome Mixtape Number 2, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 continues the team's adventures as they unravel the mystery of Peter Quill's true parentage. I like that even the plot synopsis mentions that it's set to the backdrop of Awesome Mixtape Number 2.
gotta cross promote, Mike.
Got it. Mike, I'm a big fan of James Gunn from Slither and Super. Have you seen those movies?
I've seen Slither. I have not seen Super.
Okay, both of them are really, really great. I highly recommend checking out Super. And obviously, a pretty big fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which
you don't say.
which currently seems kind of unstoppable. That said, I merely only like the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
Pump your brakes, kid.
It's good. I think
Guardians, it is good.
Guardians of the Galaxy is good. I like that movie. But to me, and I feel like I'm in the minority on this a little bit. A lot of people look at the first one as one of the best of the Marvel movies. To me, it feels dragged down both by a desire to play a little too safe and a third act, which turns into kind of a somewhat generic space battle. But I loved the characters in that movie, and I was very excited to see what a sequel freed from the confines of having to set everyone up and needing an origin for the team could do with those characters. And man, I think James Gunn delivers big time in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. This feels like pure, unfiltered banana pants, and and James Gunn directs this thing with such confidence that you're going to follow him into the madness that this movie has, and it just couldn't help but make me smile the entire time. I really enjoyed Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I think it's better than the original movie in every conceivable way. Mike, what was your overall take?
Mostly that. I mean, going in, I wasn't really worried, but I, you know, just in the back of my mind, I had this worry that it could just be the same thing again, right? Like, it could be. I didn't expect them to do that, but I was worried that it just wouldn't expand or change anything about the story.
Yeah.
But then Guardians Volume 2, is, like you said, freed from the confines of having to get the band together. We start out, we're in this insane mission to do whatever for the opening credits, and it's hilarious.
Yep.
But we find out so much about how everyone wants to kill them, and they have bounties on their heads, and, you know, they're doing a bit of both at the end, right? The last line from Guardians 1. And it's just so much fun. And I think you're right that it's full on banana pants. It's, that should be the poster quote for this movie. Because it is one of the most unique visions, I think, within the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, I think just in blockbuster filmmaking in general right now. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's doubly impressive being a Marvel movie, which kind of, you know, they sort of have a formula that they follow in some extent. And in this one, they're like, nah, we're just Guardians Volume 2. We're just going to do what the fuck we want. And it's going to be fluorescent and weird. We're going to have awesome pop music, of course.
Yep.
And there's this one particular thing that I want to talk about that I'm excited, you know, how the Marvel movies kind of expand on each other a little bit. And I feel like having Doctor Strange happen before this allows for some crazy shit that is so much fun. So I'm definitely excited to talk about those things because, you know, we're going to speculate for, I'm sure, 45 minutes because it's a Marvel movie.
Because that's what we do. That's what these movies invite in you. Like, it's almost frustrating when a Marvel movie comes out because I want to talk about the movie. But by the time the opening weekend's over, literally everyone on the internet is just talking about what the next movie's going to be.
yeah, absolutely. This movie was great, but what it really means is this.
Exactly.
Mike. Listen to my think piece about it.
Exactly. Which is what this podcast is. But I think the difference between Guardians and Guardians 2, to me, it's almost like sort of the difference between Avengers and Avengers Age of Ultron. You know, it's that both sets of films are written and directed by people known for their jokey dialogue and sort of like twisted sensibilities.
Right.
And the original in both cases, Avengers 1 and Guardians 1, is more about getting the team together. with the themes kind of buried underneath. I think Guardians has that a little more than Avengers does, the original. Comparatively, like there, it has like some weightier stuff happening, but mostly it's just about having a fun time with getting this team together. But the sequel in both cases is bigger. Maybe it's messier, but the team functions so well together and explores a lot more nuanced territory than the original does.
Yes.
I think that's true for Age of Ultron. I think it's true for this one as well. And that's not even getting into how funny this movie is, because this movie is fucking hilarious. Like the team's banter back and forth is so sharp in this movie, and like all the supporting characters are terrific. Drax and Baby Groot are fucking incredible. Big fan
the of dream this. Team.
The dream. and there's the expanded roles for Michael Rooker as Yondu and Karen Gillan as Nebula, which pay off big time. Both of those actors are terrific in this movie.
Yeah.
And the soundtrack, man, is just as expected, delightful. Like.
Yep.
You know, a lot of strong choices in there. And I think it's a big improvement over, you know, since Guardians of the Galaxy came out, we've seen some blockbusters take their cues from Guardians of the Galaxy and use like have like this big like soundtrack to punctuate their scenes. Looking at you, Suicide Squad. But that was also the case with like Kong Skull Island, you know, like
right.
Suicide Squad, it would be like, oh, we're in Louisiana. We got to play House of the Rising Sun. Or in Kong, it's like, oh, we're in the Vietnam War. Let's put on some Creedence. They just hammered you with like very obvious choices. Whereas the Guardians movies, you know, they're pretty well known songs, but they're also like a little bit deeper cuts. You know, it's not.
Yeah.
They generally fit in with whatever theme they're going to be going for in the scene. And also, what I think is kind of cool and interesting is that there's almost always an in-universe reason for why there's music playing in the scene.
Right.
You know, in the first opening sequence, you know, you see Baby Groot like kind of plug in the speakers, and then you know the speakers start playing music, and you know he's dancing, and it's amazing. But yeah, this movie it's big, like it's bold, it's colorful as all hell, weird as shit, and it's proud of it. You know, it's also I think what's kind of interesting is that it's completely separate from the rest of the Marvel universe.
Yeah, yeah. Guardians 1, I thought for a portion of its runtime, it was like, oh yeah, this is this weird thing on its own.
Yeah.
And revealed that, you know, they're handling an Infinity Stone. It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But Guardians 2, I'm pretty sure there's no real connection.
Yeah, outside of a cameo that I can think of, but that's not even like a thing. That's a cameo you'd expect to see in.
Right.
not to spoil the guy who cameos in this movie, but like, I think you can probably already guess. Let's just say he's cameoed in every single Marvel movie.
It's pretty weird to see Howard the Duck. No.
But yeah, I think all you, like, if you've seen the first movie, like, you're pretty good. Like, if you've never seen any of the other Marvel movies and you've just seen the first Guardians movie, like, you're pretty good, like, going into this. I don't think you need to see anything else. Like, I would recommend watching those other movies, but, like, to understand what's happening in this movie, you don't need to see anything, really.
Anything, yeah. Yeah, which is bold as fuck, like, what the Marvel movies are doing, right?
Yeah. They had this, like, it's all connected kind of mantra for so long, where, like, you know, the movie would, like, reference each other, and they still do that. You know, like, Civil War just happened a year ago, and, like, Doctor Strange had an Infinity Stone, and, like, Thor made a cameo at the end, and all that kind of stuff. But, like, you know, Doctor Strange, for the most part, was also kind of off on its own thing. And the original Guardians is pretty much mostly off on its own thing, except for the Infinity Stone, and, like, there's, like, a Thanos connection.
Yeah, and the Collector shows up. I think he's been in another movie, right?
He cameoed at the end of Thor 2 to just show that he will be in Guardians kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, and so, you know, this is pretty much on its own, and I think that's kind of what they're going to start doing a little bit more. Now that they've established that they're all in the same universe, they can kind of have a lot more fun.
Yeah.
They can throw in these connections when they want. They can make these cameos and stuff like that. But they can also just throw out this random space adventure and have it be completely disconnected from everything else that's happening and be like, yeah, this is part of it.
I mean, it's no surprise that this is also the thing we talk about with Star Wars, right? That we're excited for these other weird Star Wars stories movies because we've got this expanded collective universe and we could just go do this weird space thing.
Yeah.
And now we're going to get that for the Marvel, which, like I said, not a surprise. Disney, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think I'm excited, too, that with the news that James Gunn will be back for Guardians 3. He'll he'll be the first one to complete a trilogy in the Marvel Universe. So I'm pumped to see what silliness that's going to be. Yeah, like, I can't imagine how this gets weirder, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some, based on some of the post-credit scenes in this movie, I can think of some ways, but... I am pretty stoked that James Gunn is coming back to complete the trilogy. You know, I'm also interested to see where they end up in that movie, because they're going to be appearing in the next Avengers movie. Like, the Guardians are popping up in that one, probably in both of the next Avengers movies, one in 2018, one in 2019. And so it'll be interesting to see, like, how these characters exist without James Gunn. I think he'll still be involved with them in Avengers in some capacity. You know, I think he's the kind of guy who is just really upset. Like, he's been talking about how much he loves these characters for so long. And, like, you know, there's a reason he came back for Volume 3. You know, he wants to see the conclusion of these arcs and all that kind of cool stuff. It'll be interesting to see, especially, like, you know, this movie supposedly takes place, like, 4 months after the original Guardians of the Galaxy. So technically it takes place in, like, 2014. And so Avengers, the next one, will be in like 2018. So there'll be like a pretty significant time jump between Guardians 2 and Guardians 3.
Case. Yeah. They'll be just a weird as fuck, I assume they'll do a timey-wimey wibbly wobbly thing. Cause like relativity and stuff, I guess. Yeah. Right. we could just find the jump points and who knows. Yeah, right?
The interstellar defense.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So Guardians 2, had a blast with it. I thought it was so much fun. Mike, do you have any other general thoughts before we get into spoilers?
No, I think it's a ton of fun. If you liked the first one, or if you really kind of like Marvel movies in general, obviously, you'll really like this, I think.
Yeah.
I do really applaud its ability to avoid having to get the band back together story. And yet still make the band bigger, right? We have, you said, Yondu and Gamora, or Nebula, excuse me, Mantis is added to it. We get some more bigger family cast, right? Or main cast, I guess.
Yes.
And it doesn't feel like we're retreading the old things and we're getting hot takes on new stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, so that is awesome. Guardians 2, had a blast with. Highly recommend checking out. We're going to go into spoilers for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 starting right now.
Stop it! You're spoiling everything!
Hey, Mike, this weekend I watched a space opera featuring a lovable band of misfits, one of whom is covered in brown fur, and one a roguish, good-looking guy who flies a spaceship. That movie split the heroes up for most of its runtime, while one of them discovered his father was alive, only for the father to reveal sinister intentions. And also, there was a scene where they navigate an asteroid field.
Oh my god.
But enough about The Empire Strikes Back, Mike. let's talk about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
You son of a bitch. That's amazing.
I mean, honestly, this movie did remind me of Empire Strikes Back a lot for those reasons. But a much jokier Empire Strikes Back.
A much lighter
version of Empire Strikes Back.
Now I'm going to make a bold claim. When did Empire Strike Back come out? Is it 1983?
80.
80, okay. All right, never mind then.
What were you going to say?
Because I was going to say, I assumed it would be on purpose, right? Because when we flash back to Earth for young Kurt Russell things, it's 1983.
I thought it was 88. I'm pretty sure it was 88.
Is it 80? Is it? I don't remember.
I think it was. But also, young Kurt Russell, man.
Yeah, look at him go.
Whoa. Marvel has used that de-aging technology a few times now. they keep nailing it. Like, I am, like... super impressed with their stuff. Like Ant-Man was uncanny, I thought, and uncanny in like a good way. Like, it looked like him. I was like, whoa, like young Michael Douglas, not like uncanny, like Uncanny Valley. Or Robert Downey Jr. in Civil War, looked cool too. And you know, now they have young Kurt Russell in the Guardians 2. It's like, ooh, it's so weird.
Yeah, I actually saw a one of those like junket interview things with Kurt Russell, and the person asked him about it. And he told the story that he's had the same makeup guy for the last 28 movies he's made.
Really?
And he said almost all of that was just makeup. Like, really? the guy knows his face so well, apparently, for doing it, this being his makeup guy for so long, that he was like, let me just try and see what I could do. And then they were like, yeah, we didn't really need to do anything.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Or like they just had to remove some wrinkles and stuff.
That's
like,
crazy. Wow,
that's insane. Yeah.
That is awesome. But speaking of the Empire Strikes Back connection, I was thinking about doing a Fast and the Furious connection. Where
because you're just always thinking about Fast and the Furious.
Well, it's a movie where Vin Diesel plays a monosyllabic character who just can't stop talking about family.
That would have been so much better.
You think so? I think the Empire Strikes Back one was pretty good.
I mean, Empire Strikes Back was impressive. Good job,
Matt. But I think one of the remarkable things about this movie is that it doesn't even appear to have a real villain for about like 2/3 of its runtime.
Yeah,
there's a few different stories happening in this movie. There's a lot of things this movie is juggling, a lot of characters happening all at once. The movie never loses sight of any of them. So it's like kind of refreshing for a movie like this to know when to just like chill for a while. You know, it's like it's a pretty like relaxed movie, you know, for most of its runtime.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like, right, a lesser movie, that first 2/3 would feel meandering, right? Like we're not doing anything, kind of. We're just watching a bunch of people like hang out, it seems like, and relax, like, kind of go on vacation.
I mean, almost like you're, for at least in the Peter Quill, Gamora, Drax subplot.
Yes.
Of the movie. Yeah. But then you have like, you know, the stuff with Rocket and Groot and Yondu getting captured and stuff like that. That's happening simultaneously, and Nebula and all that stuff. So there is other stuff happening in the movie.
Yeah.
But I think,
I don't want to misconstrue that. That's how I felt. I'm saying a worse movie wouldn't be like that.
Right. But because
this movie, it's some. Go ahead.
Well, what I was kind of saying is that, you know, this movie, it's kind of refreshing that it is able to just kind of chill and like build character moments and like know when to slow down and stuff like that. Because, you know, there's something like Star Wars, The Force Awakens, which a movie I like a lot. I like Star Wars, Force Awakens quite a bit. But that movie is just nonstop. Like it never like just stops to breathe for a minute. You know?
Yeah.
And so like you get the characters and like I like the characters in that movie, but it's not like the original Star Wars where you have like, you know, there's an hour before you even show up at the Death Star in that movie, you know, and it's just like Luke on Tatooine with Obi-Wan. And it's great. And, you know, I kind of missed that in Star Wars, The Force Awakens, where you have that kind of like just time to get to know the character a little bit and like, you know, build a relationship with these people. And I think Guardians 2 does that. It's kind of cool on that front. And but of course, Kurt Russell as Ego, Peter Quill's father, ultimately ends up the big bad of this movie. And of course, he's great. Naturally, he's Kurt Russell. And I think what's cool about that is that, you know, Marvel has always kind of had a problem creating memorable villains, I think, you know, in most of their movies anyway, outside of like Loki and Ultron, I would say. But those to me are like the really memorable villains. Like, you know, for example, just look to Ronan in Guardians 1. Who is like a nothing. He's a nothing villain. You know, he's a little bit better than Malekith and Thor 2. I look at Malekith and Thor 2 as like the worst villain of all time. he's such a boring villain. Ronan is not much better. But they've been like improving a little bit in the villain department. You know, Baron Zemo in Civil War wasn't like super memorable, but he had like a really interesting role in that movie.
Yeah,
and you know there was Mads Mikkelsen who had some funny stuff in Doctor Strange, and Dormammu popping up at the end of Doctor Strange was cool. But this seems like a huge step up from that stuff. It kind of like uses Kurt Russell's very casual persona, and like kind of like invites you into his world, and like he's, you know, very inviting and he's warm. And he's Kurt Russell. And he's lovable. And he's great.
He's so handsome.
And then he's the bad guy, and he like kind of creates menace in that way. And I think that's kind of cool. And Yondu, man, turns out to be the heart of this movie. Did not see that one coming.
No. Yeah, I'm really glad at the, like, you know, the expanded Guardians family, I guess, right? We mentioned it earlier, but having Nebula and Yondu come in and be much more instrumental to the story and part, quote unquote, part of the team, right?
Nebula, the Jason Statham of of the Guardians family. That's been put together.
Yep, pretty much. But I think that's so much fun, right? Because I think that adds to the Guardians kind of like separate universe, right? In some weird way, like we have that's kind of it. They're the Space Avengers, effectively, right? Like to put it very simply, right? Because it's the same kind of stuff that we get with the Avengers at home, like on Earth in those movies.
Yeah,
where like Colby Smulders, you know, kind of is part of the team, but like they're not the key figure and like all that kind of stuff. And I think that's, and it's this weird fluorescent version of it. And it's so much fun to just, it's such a sight to behold.
Yeah, absolutely. And Michael Rooker, man, is great as Yondu. I've always been a big Michael Rooker fan. You know, he's popped up in all of James Gunn's movies. He was in Slither. He was in Super. He's probably most well-known for his role in The Walking Dead, where he played Merle, Daryl's brother, and he was great on that show. And, you know, I think his arc running parallel to Peter Quill's arc, where they both kind of realize what they mean to each other throughout the course of the movie, I think that, to me, is really skillful storytelling. And then Yondu's sacrifice at the end is so perfectly played, I think. And the Ravager funeral that follows is just nice. It's so lovely.
Many manly tears are shed.
Yeah. Also, a shout out to Sean Gunn as Kraglin, who's James Gunn's brother. He's Yondu's number two guy.
Oh, really? That's his brother?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I
didn't know that.
He was in the first Guardians, but it was like a much smaller role. And now, in this movie, he kind of becomes like a lot of these other supporting characters. He gets much more of a role in this movie. And he's he's great. I find his devotion to Yondu really like endearing. But also, like, he has a lot of the funniest lines in the movie. He's got some really good stuff happening. So shout out to Sean Gunn. Good stuff there. I think he was also on Gilmore Girls, I think. Like, I want to say it was Gilmore Girls, he had a pretty big role on that show.
I thought he was like the mocap guy for Rocket or something.
He was,
the
mocap guy for Rocket.
That's amazing.
Speaking of Rocket, I wanted to shout out the prison break sequence with Yondu, Rocket, and Baby Groot, because that was amazing.
That's ridiculous.
That was so good. Just them escaping prison with Yondu using his arrow, like going through dudes left and right. Just some cool ass action. There's a lot of like death in this movie.
Yeah, I've never been so like like relaxed during the relentless murder of apparently hundreds of people.
Yeah. I mean, like, here's the thing. I was thinking about this because that's like a criticism that has been levied at some superhero movies where, like, you know, the hero kills people or is indifferent to the death of people, like something like Man of Steel or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, that's been leveled at some Marvel movies in the past, too. And I think it's different in this franchise because I don't expect the Guardians to be like the paragons of virtue that like somebody like Captain America would be. You know?
Right. Yeah. They're definitely not set up that way at all.
Exactly. Even like when they first meet Kurt Russell and Peter's like debating about whether he wants to go with him, Gamora says to him like, yeah, you know, we'll go, we'll see how it is. And then if, you know, he turns out to be evil, we'll just kill him.
I mean, they're outlaws, right? They're the Guardians of the Galaxy. And at the same time, they are wanted by all these different people. They want, you know, people have money up for their heads and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's kind of freeing, you know, like, right. I mean, like, obviously, because you don't have to worry about morality when they're just wantonly killing space pirates, basically.
And in general, they're only killing people that are trying to kill them, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And in the first one, the guys are those like weird necrophage dudes that like aren't real people, it seems. They don't seem like they're people. I don't know.
Right.
It's been a while since I've seen the first one, but it allowed that scene with the, I can't remember the song that's playing during it, but
I'm what that song was too.
The breakout scene is so much fun. And that's always the thing with these movies, right? Like you said, the music doesn't feel completely shoehorned in like it does in Suicide Squad or something like that.
I wouldn't say that. I think there are scenes where it does feel a little shoehorned. Like, it's not bad.
Yeah, well, I guess, like you said, it works. The music almost always fits the theme of whatever scene they're doing. It's not just like, here's time for rock song. Like, it's usually for a reason, it seems.
Here's time for a rock song. No, I agree with that. But it does, like the excuse, because, like, what part of what I said before, like, they try to make it like an in-universe reason for why the music is happening.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times it'll just be like Rocket being like, hey, can you put music on the loudspeakers? Like, is that a thing we can do?
Yeah. I mean, that is the opening credits, right? He's spending time building speakers.
Yes, that's true. But even like in that prison breakout scene, he says like, okay, I'm going to need this, and I'm going to need you, and does Quill have any of his music left on the ship? And and so that's when the song starts playing over the loudspeakers. And so it's like, okay, well, like, if we need an excuse for why the song's playing, then whatever. That's fine.
Sure, why not?
I did want to talk about the reveal that Ego killed Peter Quill's mother. That hits pretty hard.
Yeah.
And I think it really makes the rest of the movie land. Like, Quill goes through a lot over the course of this movie. And Pratt does a good job. You know, I think Pratt's, Chris Pratt loved him on Parks and Recreation. He's one of the best characters in that show. Yeah. And then, you know, he was in Guardians of the Galaxy and, like, kind of blew everyone away. It was like, oh, shit, Chris Pratt's, like, an action star now. But he was, like, a goofy action star in Guardians, you know?
Yeah.
And I think he is still that in this movie. But in between Guardians and Guardians 2, you know, he starred in Jurassic World, and he starred in, like, Magnificent Seven, and he starred in Passengers. And I feel like he kept starring in these movies that didn't really take advantage of the fact that he's, like, a really funny guy.
Yeah.
You know? Which is weird, considering he was on Parks and Recreation for 7 years, and like,
and like
the reason, and like the reason he became a big star was Guardians of the Galaxy, where he was being a pretty funny guy. But like, you know, watching him in Jurassic World, he's just like very stoic, and like, I never understood why that was. You know,
yeah,
like it doesn't really seem like it's suited to his strengths. And so in this movie, he's doing a lot of goofier stuff, but then he has that like these like emotional moments with Kurt Russell's character and. You know, I think they land. I think Pratt does a really good job in those moments. Maybe because they're offset by the goofier moments. I'm not really sure why. But I think it does work.
I think it definitely allows his character to become more rounded, right? Like, he is, for most of the first one, most of Guardians 1, the kind of, like, roguish, silly jokester guy.
Yeah.
And like you said, in this one, we're allowed to... He is shown to have... feelings, right? I mean, like, we get glimpses of that in Guardians 1, but Guardians 2 dives into it much deeper. His that reaction when Kurt Russell ego reveals that it's like, oh, I had to do what I had to do and put that tumor in her brain, and that like immediate reaction of Star-Lord to just draw his guns and blow ego away, like, tells a lot about him. It's the equivalent of Han shooting first, right? Like, it's the same. And I think that's awesome. That's a really cool way to go about characterizing him, instead of telling us something about him, right? Like, instead of a show don't tell, right?
Yeah. And then even at the same time, I feel like this is much more an ensemble movie than Guardians 1, whereas Guardians 1, I feel like it's much more about, like, it's about the team coming together. But it starts off, you know, with Star-Lord, and it's like the movie's kind of about his, every character kind of has an arc in Guardians 1.
Teeny little bit.
It's mostly about Star-Lord, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, maybe Groot.
For marketing purposes.
For marketing purposes. But I feel like in this movie, like, every character has an arc, and all those arcs play off of each other in really interesting ways. I really loved Mantis's relationship with Drax in this movie, and how they play off each other. That's, again, a case of, like, opposites looking out for each other. The scene where, like, Mantis bursts into tears as soon as she touches Drax's shoulder when he's thinking about his dead wife and child. That's, like, one of the best moments in the movie. That's, like, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
because
that was awesome.
Drax is such a stoic guy. Like, his race is, like, so, like, serious all the time. And, like, he's become a much goofier character in this movie than in the first one. Like, he was a goofy character because he was so stoic in the first one. And now I think after spending time with the Guardians for a few months, he's become a much goofier person.
Yeah, it definitely seems like he is starting to learn metaphors, right?
Yeah.
I think he does. He might even make a few at some point, and I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
But it is, that's such an interesting also, like, progression for his character, and to see him go from, you know, he's kind of there just for his chance to kill Ronan and or Thanos in the first one. And in the second one, this team is family for all of them, and it means a lot for the whole arc for everyone, is discovering what family means individually. Which, like you said, somehow this movie manages to be an ensemble movie and handle six arcs that kind of all intertwine a tiny, like, a little bit, just enough to keep the story as a movie, as a team movie, instead of being six different movies we're watching, I guess.
Yeah, it is pretty insane. And I did want to also shout out the Gamora/Nebula relationship, which gets a lot more room to breathe in this movie. I feel like in the first one, it's kind of dumped out in, like, an exposition scene. You know,
right.
And so it gets a lot more room to breathe in this one than the last one. And I think it helps out a lot. Also very much enjoyed their North by Northwest scene that they had going on.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
where Nebula was chasing down Gamora in a spaceship. It was pretty cool. Yeah, really just in general, like, every character seems, like, substantially more fully formed than in the original. You know, they feel like they've been doing their space thing for a few months now. They know each other pretty well, and it makes for a really easy movie to watch, I feel like. Like, I feel like I can just, like, put this... I feel like this is a movie that I can put on any time and just kind of enjoy. Which I think the Marvel movies generally are do a pretty good job of doing that. But some are more successful than others, and I think this one is one of the better ones in that regard. Like, something like Civil War is a movie that I liked a lot, but it's also not one that I feel like I can put on, like, any time, you know?
Yeah, Civil War is pretty heavy. to just throw on.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the post-credit scenes in this movie, Mike, because there are five of them.
There are five of
them. There are five post-credits in this movie, which is twice as much, more than twice as much as any other Marvel movie has had so far. Two of them are joke ones, right? There's one where Sean Gunn is trying out Yondu's arrow, and he stabs Drax, and it's hilarious.
That's the best.
And one in which there's a teenage Groot now. And he's like a sullen teenager who's like playing on his iPad, and Peter Quill is like you got to clean up your room, and that was also really funny. Especially just for like the disaffected delivery of I am Groot was
and like his tone of clearly mocking, like the really sarcastic I am Groot. Yes. That's amazing.
was pretty great. I mean, just as a side note, why did they still pay Vin Diesel for this movie?
I don't know. It's so cool that they do, though.
I'm happy that it's still Vin Diesel, but like he's playing Baby Groot in this movie. So yeah. At least even in the first movie, like it was a little ridiculous that it was Vin Diesel, but because he was just saying the words "I am Groot" over and over and over again, and that could have been anybody. But at least it was in Vin Diesel's voice, right? Like he was doing his own Groot thing, and it sounded like Vin Diesel. In this movie, he's playing Baby Groot, and his voice is pitched up much higher.
Yeah, it's basically Chipmunk. I am Chipmunk Groot,
and so you can't even tell that it's Vin Diesel playing it. But at the same time, I think it's pretty hilarious that Vin Diesel is playing Baby Groot in this movie, and he does it in every language too. So maybe that's it. I don't know.
That's the best part.
But yeah, I could have watched before we get into some of those other post-credit scenes, I could have watched 4 hours of Baby Groot dancing to ELO at the beginning, because that was amazing.
I love that they kept that thing, right? Because the opening credits of Guardians 1 is a dance sequence with Star-Lord. But I kind of love how this opening credits like subverts your action movie expectations in some weird way, right? Because it's just Baby Groot dancing in the foreground while an out of focus like boss action battle happens in the background.
Exactly.
Like, it's so great. It's best.
So good. And I actually got into an argument with some folks the other day about Baby Groot, because a couple of my friends didn't care for Baby Groot that much. They saw Baby Groot as like this crass marketing ploy on the scale of Minions. And I strongly disagree with that, because this is an entirely new character that was established at the end of the last one. Like, that's kind of what I find interesting about Baby Groot, is that Groot himself died, right? Like, he actually did die. And this is like a reborn version of Groot who has, he doesn't have like any of the memories that the original Groot has.
It certainly doesn't seem that way.
Yeah. And so, and B, like his presence changes the entire dynamic of the team, you know, because in the first movie, it's Groot and the team. Now it's Baby Groot and the team. And just from that, you have a whole different dynamic going on. In that first movie, he protected them, right? He was their protector at the end. He sacrificed himself to save them, and now they have to protect him because he's small and vulnerable, you know. You know, it brings out something different in them. So in that opening sequence where Groot is dancing, like there are a lot of like parts where like, you know, the character will like jump into frame and like have to protect Groot from something as he's dancing. So in addition to being adorable, you know, I also think Baby Groot brings a lot to the table in this one. And I think we're going to be more invested in that character for future movies, because we'll have seen him grow up as the movies go on, I assume.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen him as Baby Groot, and now we've seen him as Teenage Groot in the post credits. And I assume he'll be some kind of more adult Groot in the Avengers movie by the time we get to that.
Right.
You know, I'm pretty sure Baby Groot is just for this movie.
The post credit scene seems to
indicate that.
Suggest that, yeah.
And so there's that. But yeah, I assume we'll get an older Groot later on. But I've actually heard that James Gunn has said that the Groot in the first movie isn't the full Groot. Like, it's not like the biggest Groot can get.
Ooh,
that's not full size Groot. So I think Guardians 3 might have like an even bigger Groot to go with.
That's awesome.
Which will be interesting. So I like that they're changing the dynamics of the team pretty much like movie by movie with this kind of Groot thing. Because even just, you know, replacing one character and putting in a smaller version of that character changes the entire dynamic of the movie, which I think is kind of neat. But let's get back to these post-credit scenes. So we mentioned the two that were jokes. One of them hints at the presence of Adam Warlock, who that's the, you know, there's the part in the Golden Person's throne room, Aisha, the Golden Person's throne room, where she's their council is upset at her because she wasted all their resources trying to get the Guardians, and then she didn't even do it. And so she's saying about how she has this project in the works, and she's going to call him Adam. And so Adam Warlock is this pretty huge cosmic Marvel character who's actually pretty heavily involved in the defeat of Thanos in the comics.
Okay.
And presumably he won't be involved in the defeat of Thanos in these movies, but James Gunn has been talking about using him for a long time. Like, I think he wanted to include him in Guardians 2, but he just wasn't. It just wasn't there. Like, I think he was saying that you know, he already had Mantis in the movie,
right?
And you know, you're adding too many new characters, and so he ended up just taking out Adam Warlock and saving it for 3.
Right.
And so that's something, because I think people have been speculating about Adam Warlock since the first one came out, because that was like something that people really wanted to see.
Yeah, I think it'll be really interesting too, because I have read the Infinity Gauntlet storyline from the in the comics. I don't remember specifically Adam Warlock, but I do remember that there are like the Celestials as beings weigh in heavily in that thing, and I always wondered, like, how the fuck are they gonna pull this, like, time as a character, you know, like death as a character, yeah. Like, you know, Lady Death is a pretty big character throughout the Marvel Universe in general, right. But like all these really weird high concept stuff, and I was like I think Galactus is there, like, which obviously they can't do, but like it's always been like this one thing that I'm excited to see how they handle that stuff, like all these people that show up for this battle. And I like I was saying before earlier with, like, you know, the introduction of Doctor Strange and all of the things that come with that, like the mysticism and the reality and universe hopping and controlling time and stuff, like I feel like they're just going to do it. Like they're going to somehow be able to pull it off.
It's going to be nuts. And then there's a couple other post-credit scenes. One of them involves the original Guardians of the Galaxy reuniting, which is
what that was.
That's what that team was.
Okay. Yeah.
So, okay. First of all, Sylvester Stallone is in this movie.
Right. Which is what?
Which is pretty nuts. And it's only for like a scene at the beginning and then a scene at the end. And then he's in that post-credit scene, reuniting the Guardians of the Galaxy. But here's the thing. So Sylvester Stallone's in it, and it was cool to see him. I was very excited to see Sylvester Stallone. I knew he was in the movie, but it was like cool to see him, even if it was just for a scene. And I think James Gunn is saying that he wants to use that character in more movies.
Okay.
During the Ravager funeral, you know, it was cutting to all the different Ravager ships, and it would show like somebody, and it's like, oh, Yondu is a great man. Sylvester Stallone would be there. It's like, oh yeah, Yondu. And then it cut to another ship, and I like did a double take, and I was like, is that Ving Rhames?
That fucking Ving Rhames.
Fucking Ving Rhames. what? And like, I didn't like believe that it was Ving Rhames in my head, because I was like, why would they get Ving Rhames just for like this one scene? I don't
this
get it.
This weird cameo, yeah.
And then one of the other ones was Michelle Yeoh from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Right.
Which was nuts also. And so then this post-credit scene happens, and it's Sylvester Stallone, Ving Rhames, Michelle Yeoh, Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex Luthor on Smallville, and a robot that's voiced by Miley Cyrus.
What?
Yeah.
Sure.
And they're all gathered together, and they're playing the team that made up the original Guardians of the Galaxy in the comics.
Oh my god.
So, because that's the team that Yondu was a part of in the original comics. And the movies that we're watching is based on the 2008 version of the team.
Right.
The newer version. This is like the original like 70s Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
And so that's what all those characters are. That's who all those actors are.
Yeah. Wait, which one was the guy from Smallville? The like fish dude?
I guess, yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. So like give me that movie right damn now. Like
I need
that cast to in a full movie right now. And I hope that happens. I think Marvel might have just made it like a fun thing for like fans of Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever, maybe. But since James Gunn is saying he wants Sylvester Stallone to be in more movies, and like they're kind of using that character as like a potential cornerstone of the Marvel Universe, who knows? I really hope that team shows up in like Guardians 3 or something, because holy shit.
It certainly seemed that way, right? Because he says like, oh, it took the death of one of our own to bring us back together. Let's go steal some shit. And then like smash cut back to the credits. And I was like, what?
Exactly. Like
I felt like it was either a hook for something else or just like a fun cameo, because it was Sylvester Stallone and Michelle Yeoh and Ving Rhames. Like,
it was so weird. But yeah, like if I don't get a full movie starring Sylvester Stallone, Ving Rhames, Michelle Yeoh, and a robot voiced by Miley Cyrus in space,
I'm out.
I'm out of the whole Marvel Universe. I'm done. That is just a holy shit. So that blew my mind. That was pretty insane. And then there is one final post-credit scene, which builds off a cameo from earlier in the film, the Stan Lee cameo, which also fucking blew my mind.
Yeah.
Now, did you understand what was happening in that scene, Mike? Because I know you're not as well versed in the Marvel universe as I am.
If I remember correctly, they are. Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think it is. I thought they were the people that, when the Collector is in the Guardians 1, he's showing us the history of that Infinity Stone. We see people holding all the Infinity Stones, and I thought that was them that he's talking to.
Maybe, but no.
I think those guys die in that vision that we see in the history of the Infinity Stone. It whiffed me.
Let me explain to you.
Yeah.
Some stuff here
for my edification, Mike.
So Stan Lee has his cameo in this movie during the scene where Rocket and Yondu and Baby Groot are like jumping through hyperspace or whatever. Which is also hilarious, by the way. Their faces.
That was the thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah,
their faces are bananas. But they're bouncing through these different planets and stuff. And they go through one planet, and it's Stan Lee in a spacesuit, surrounded by these three blue, big-headed men.
Yeah.
And those guys are the Watchers. In the Marvel universe, the Watchers are these guys who look over everything in the Marvel universe. Yeah, they watch. And the idea is that they are there for every significant event in the history of the universe and time itself and all that kind of stuff. It's a really insane cosmic thing. And the Watchers watch everything. They're not allowed to interfere with anything. But whenever the Watchers show up, they always interfere with whatever shit's happening in the Marvel universe. Uatu is the most famous Watcher, which is not like a famous name. But Uatu, the Watcher, is a big thing in the Marvel universe. And so Stan Lee, in his cameo, is talking to the Watchers, and he's saying to them, yeah, and this one time I was a FedEx employee, which was his cameo in Civil War.
Right.
And so there was a theory going around the internet a while back that Stan Lee was playing the same character in every single Marvel movie.
He's just playing Stan Lee.
Well, in this movie, he's credited in the credits as Watcher's informant.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Which means that theory is confirmed. Stan Lee is playing is the same character in every Marvel movie, and he's playing some kind of informant for these Watchers.
You know, I'm like, really, now that when you say it, then you put all those pieces together, of fucking course he is. It's the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Like,
yeah.
Things don't just happen.
I jumped in my seat when I saw that happening.
Yeah, that's amazing. It
was fucking insane, man. So that's, I mean, holy shit. That's...
I
jumped in my seat. Like, that's something that is so quick that it's not going to take away your enjoyment. You're just going to be like, oh, look, that's a Stan Lee cameo. Like,
yeah, I thought it was just like a silly, oh, look, it's Stan Lee stuck on an asteroid somewhere or whatever.
Like, how did that happen? Wild, whatever. Yeah. But like, if you know what like those characters are, you're like, holy shit.
That's amazing.
The fact that he's describing that he was a FedEx employee, and like that was a Civil War cameo, and so like you assume that all of his cameos happened, and so I think this honestly, like, that would be a perfect final Stan Lee cameo. Like, if he never made another cameo, and I'm sure I think they've already filmed his cameos.
Filmed a bunch.
Because he's like 93, so I think they filmed the next few cameos in the events that like he's not able to film another one. You know, they've already filmed quite a few. But if that was the last one, that would have been, what a way to go out.
And what he says at the end of it, like, so that's his cameo, right? That first one, when he's like, oh, one time I was a FedEx employee. And then what he says during the post-credits scene, as they're walking away from him, is like, no, wait, I have so many more stories. Come back.
Yes.
Which makes so much sense.
I think he also says like, you're my ride or something, which.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Some Stan Lee thing.
Yeah.
But yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Fucking Marvel.
It's insane. It's insane. Yeah, and this movie has those cameos, man. It has the Howard the Duck cameo in the middle, which they also had in the first movie, in the post-credits of that one.
Yeah, I think we get Laika again, or the Laika's in the credits, the Russian dog, the Soviet dog.
The dog is in the credits. Also, there's a Jeff Goldblum cameo in the credits.
I saw that.
As his character from Thor Ragnarok, which is cool to see. Also, David Hasselhoff cameo.
Yeah.
Which was pretty great. And he also sings the song at the end.
I noticed that.
Which is like this Guardians of the Galaxy theme song, which I was so happy that that existed.
It took me a while before I realized. I was like, wait, is this David Hasselhoff? That's amazing.
I didn't even have that. I was listening to the song and I was like, it wasn't even like registering what song was playing. I just assumed it was like some kind of like soundtrack like pick song, or whatever. Yeah. And then like as the song was playing, I was like, wait, is this song about the movie? Is this, Guardians theme song? We never get these anymore. This is amazing.
It's your favorite thing.
Yeah, I've talked about this in the podcast. You know, we need more. We need more things like the end credits of Amos and Andrew. There's a lot of crossover with The Complete Works in this episode.
Yeah, we need a Sir Mix-a-Lot rap.
So, and it's sung by David Hasselhoff, which is just amazing. That's so cool. So cool. Is there any other spoilery things you want to talk about, Mike, in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, or do you think we've wrapped up all the stuff we wanted to say?
I think we've exhausted most of it, but I do want to mention that scene when Rocket and Yondu and Baby Groot and Sean Gunn's character, whose name I can't remember, Kraglin, are doing the, like, dimension, like, hyperspace jumps or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
Which, that's another thing I am excited to unpack. Are they jumping dimensions? Are they time traveling? Like, what are they going through universes? Like, what's happening there?
My takeaway is that it was like hyperspace in Star Wars, you know, where it's just jumping like really fast, like to different areas of the universe.
Locations, yeah.
That was my takeaway. But that, like, just the visuals of that were insane, and like I couldn't believe I was watching that in a mainstream blockbuster movie. You
know, yeah. But then the thing, like, you know, Yondu says, like, oh, the limit is 10 jumps or 50 jumps or whatever he says.
Right.
We're about to do 500. And they're just a montage of them screaming and their face just warbling into different shapes.
It is pretty insane. We haven't even really talked about the fact that Kurt Russell plays a planet in this movie.
He plays a literal god planet thing.
Like a literal god planet. His name is Ego the Living Planet. That's his name. and yeah, he plays like this interdimensional god who has spread his seed across the galaxy, for lack of a better term.
I mean, literally, he plants things.
Yeah. and that's kind of the thing. I was actually surprised to see some of the climax of this movie take place on Earth.
Yes.
Which I didn't expect. And, like, you know, in the first movie, there was the opening scene that took place on Earth. This movie has the opening scene that takes place on Earth, and that was all I had expected. But so there is, like, a little bit of a payoff to that opening scene when you see the plants outside that Dairy Queen kind of start exploding into this gigantic bubble. I believe that the guy in the car that's driving away from the bubble is Peter Quill's grandfather from the first movie. I'm like 90% sure about that.
I would have to double check again because I'm pretty sure that person's one of the people dancing in the credits.
Is he?
I think so. I thought I noticed that. Towards the end, it gets pretty weird with who's there.
Okay. There were so many people in the credits just dancing around. Also, some of the credits would just say, "I am Groot" for a second. And then
it was great. I love that. But I think that I thought that was a really clever way. Because, I mean, besides the Infinity Stone that's on Nova, right? I'm pretty sure that's where they put the...
Yeah, that's where they put the orb.
The orb from Guardians 1. Like, what's the connect? I mean, obviously there's the Thanos connection and stuff. Like in the greater story, but how do you get the Guardians to Earth, right?
Right.
And we had this thing that Ego planted, this plant that exploded into this weird blob thing that will directly connect them to Earth. I mean, obviously, I guess Quill is from there, so eventually we'll end up back on Earth. But
yeah, I mean, I think, I'm not sure if that will end up being how they end up getting back to Earth, but it's definitely a possibility. You know, I think the Thanos connection, I think, is the biggest thing. Because Thanos, they're building up as this big bad, and the Guardians are the only ones who have any connection to Thanos right now. You know?
Like, right.
So I think that the fact that Thanos will be showing up on Earth, maybe, is why the Guardians will show up to try to defeat him. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm so pumped for that moment, right? Or just to see how that happens. That connection of getting Guardians to the Avengers. Is going to be a lot of fun, I think.
I think so, too, yeah. It's going to be insane. Like, I have no idea how that movie's going to be. I mean, I'm sure it'll be good. Like, Marvel has not let me down at this point.
So far, yeah.
So far. And, you know, being directed by the Russos, who did Winter Soldier and Civil War, so, like, I got faith. But it's going to be an insane movie. Like, it's going to be... I was just looking at the cast list on Wikipedia, and, like, holy shit, man.
It's like 97 people, at least.
It's so many characters. You know, you have all the Guardians of the Galaxy. You have all of the Avengers. You have... Doctor Strange, and you have Spider-Man, and you have supporting characters from all the movies. I'm pretty sure Nebula's in it, and I'm pretty sure Valkyrie from Thor Ragnarok is supposed to be in it, and like Black Panther will probably be there, and like there's gonna be so much stuff going on.
I'm very excited.
Yeah, it's gonna be great.
It is.
And then we still have two more Marvel movies this year, Mike, to have these hour-long discussions about.
Hashtag bless.
Yeah, Spider-Man Homecoming and Thor Ragnarok both hitting this year, so that's pretty cool. Spider-Man Homecoming in just 2 months.
Wow. When is Thor? November or something,
November,
probably?
Yeah.
November? Okay. Yeah, we've been talking about it. slash I've been talking about it, the three Marvel movie of year future, and we're here, Mike.
Yeah, we finally made it, Ma. it's pretty wild. And plus, I mean, that's on top of all the other superhero movies that are coming out.
Right.
With this year, we had Logan. We're going to have Wonder Woman and Justice League. And next year, we'll have Aquaman and three different X-Men movies to look forward to. Right, because Deadpool 2 is out.
Right.
And what was it? New Mutants is out. And also X-Men Dark Phoenix is out. Those will all be of varying quality, I am sure. But
yeah.
But so far, Marvel still keeping it strong, man. 15 movies in. And, you know, I do think, like, there are some that are weaker than others, but overall, this is just, I consistently marvel at the Marvel Universe.
Finger guns.
I realized halfway through the word Marvel, I was like, oh no, I'm going to do this. All right.
What have I done?
But yeah, so that is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Obviously, we are pretty big fans. I think it's in my top five Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. For me, anyway, I think it's Winter Soldier, Age of Ultron, Iron Man 3, Avengers, and Guardians 2. I think those are my overall top five.
Yeah, I would agree with that for the most part. I think I would throw Doctor Strange and maybe even Ant-Man. I would put Ant-Man in my top five.
Would you now?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that movie.
Yeah, Ant-Man is solid. I actually think Ant-Man's one of the weaker ones, but that's, you know, it's all subjective, man.
Yeah. There's 15 movies to pick from.
Yeah, and most of them are pretty good. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Plus, you can find my work at crookedscoreboard.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike DiCrescio. If you are listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks for the next Film Bookcast, where we'll probably be reviewing Alien Covenant. So pretty stoked for that one, man. I've been rewatching all the Alien movies in preparation, and also because I'm getting paid to write an article for a website. But
that doesn't hurt.
That doesn't hurt either. But yeah, I've been rewatching them. I've watched the first four so far.
Wow.
And yeah, it's good stuff, man. Even like the bad ones,
it's still fun.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing: like Alien and Aliens are basically perfect movies.
Yeah.
And then Alien 3, super underrated. I got to tell you, I mean, I watched the director's cut of Alien 3. There's a lot of good stuff in that movie. Alien Resurrection is terrible, but it does have Ron Perlman dual wielding pistols while hanging upside down off a ladder. So like, can't be
do it just for that.
Yeah. So yeah, and I'm debating whether I want to rewatch Alien vs. Predator or not.
I don't think they count.
I mean, they don't. But like Lance Henriksen's in the first one, you know?
Really?
Yeah, he's and he's playing like the human that Bishop was based on. So like I guess they're kind of canon. I don't know.
I guess they are. Yeah.
But I don't know. I like the Alien vs. Predators are really rough. But like Prometheus, I actually ended up enjoying quite a bit, and I haven't seen it since it was in theaters. So I'm eager to rewatch that one before Alien Covenant comes out, in any case. And that's probably going to be the most relevant one to whatever Alien Covenant ends up being, since they're both Ridley Scott movies, and this one kind of continues the story from that one. So that's going to be very exciting. And you can check out our next Complete Works, too, where we'll be talking Nicolas Cage's directorial debut, 2002's Sonny, starring James Franco. So that should be interesting as well.
There'll be a lot to say, I think.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Excited to dive into Nick Cage's directorial chops. If you recall, he was sort of the uncredited director on Trapped in Paradise.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
Yep.
Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. You learn to fly. Your 5,000 candles in